Welcome to our Changing the Narrative podcast, where we engage in thought-provoking conversations about housing, homelessness, and community with local and national experts. I'm Anne Miske, President and CEO of Union Station Homeless Services. Today's episode is entitled, Drug Addiction is Not the Root Cause of Homelessness. Joining me today is Laura Guzman, a California-based human rights activist and a nonprofit leader with 30-plus years of experience serving, building capacity, and organizing across communities, the intersections of harm reduction, homelessness, health, and housing, with a focus on working with the Latinx immigrant communities. Welcome, Laura. It's wonderful to have you with us today.
Good morning. I'm really excited to be here with the Union Station team.
Sean Morrissey is our Vice President of Advocacy and Community Engagement at Union Station Homeless Services, with a mission to advocate for best practices and policies around homelessness, housing, and housing sustainability. Sean brings extensive knowledge of the issues involved in addressing homelessness, with 20 years of experience in the field of homeless advocacy, service provision, and social justice, with a focus on mental health and substance use disorders. Sean, always a pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you, Anne. I'm glad to be here. Honored.
So today we're going to be talking about a myth that we hear all the time, and that is that most of the people on the streets are drug addicts or that drug addiction causes homelessness. I'm excited that today we have two experts with us that are really going to help us dive deeply into this issue of substance use and homelessness. Laura, you're an expert in harm reduction, and I'd like you to talk a little bit about what does that mean in regards to the conversation we're having on substance use, and how is that something that can really help deal with this issue?
So I think it's important to have a little bit of history. Harm reduction was founded or birthed 30 years ago at the time that people were dying of AIDS, and basically government and even public health abandoned people who use drugs who at one point were 50% of all people that were acquiring HIV/AIDS, and there was no particular strategy whatsoever to support people not to keep transmitting the disease and therefore dying at the time. So harm reduction was born out of that movement. It is a set of principles and practices that actually help not only help people to have safer use if they're ready, willing, and able not to give up using drugs, but also to prevent the very epidemics and the very costly and harmful diseases such as HIV, hepatitis C, skin tissue infections like endocarditis, and at this point, overdose death, to actually intervene with people who may be impacted by substance use disorder, but also people who may have never have used any drugs and all of a sudden they try and smoke fentanyl, or they go and try cocaine and actually the drug that they purchase is 100% fentanyl. So more than ever, harm reduction strategies continue to be the best public health approach to reduce death and reduce the cost of infection diseases and overdoses.
And we see harm reduction in sex ed. And of course, there's backlash on that happening now too, right? But it's practicing safe sex so you don't transmit diseases, et cetera, or get pregnant is also harm reduction.
The first time that I heard it, so I was in my 30s, I thought, oh my God, this is common sense. We're going to try to support people to reduce the harms that are caused not only by illicit and illicit drug use, but also by all the systems that we have in this country that actually systematically impact and stigmatize, criminalize, and target people who use drugs who are poor.
Sean, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Yeah, harm reduction often tends to be much harder work than abstinence-based work or case management because we are allowing people to have consequences. You know, we grow and learn from consequences. You know, we make mistakes and there's a consequence attached to that. And for me, hopefully I learn how to move forward and not repeat some of those same things. So we're definitely not trying to remove consequences. We appreciate that there are consequences associated with some decisions. It more has to do with the type of consequences that we've created or are punishing people with.
Yeah, we're not condoning certain things. We're just saying the way we've gone about it as a society to stigmatize is doing so much harm because then people aren't coming forward to the help that they may want or need because they're judged. I just want to look at some stats that I found really interesting. If you look at the numbers nationally, we have approximately 650,000 people on any given night in America who experience homelessness. Of that number, the estimates are around 35 to 40% suffer from some kind of substance use, whether alcohol or drugs or a combination of the two. So that works out to, let's say, approximately 260,000 people on our streets who are experiencing substance use issues. Now let's look at the big population. There are over 16 million people in this country who use substances. 16 million people. Of that, about 74%, it's alcohol, a legal drug that a lot of us use regularly. A stark difference between how many people are actually in housing who have substance abuse issues and then on the streets. And I just kind of wanted to frame our conversation because I found those stats really interesting.
It's almost like a fiction, right? That the only people who use drugs are people who are homeless. The Harm Reduction Coalition believes that in some ways we accept, for better or worse, that it's part of the human experience to use drugs. In fact, even if you go to archaeological discoveries to see how far back as humans we've been involved with drug taking and how our brains in some ways are built that way, we're also very mindful the way in which class and racism and other factors contribute to the way that we understand drug use in a way that is very distorted.
Yeah, I think that's right. And Sean, I'm going to put you on the spot because I know that I heard you say about drugs and what is the most lethal drug that's out there?
Not to be glib, but cheeseburgers, food, heart disease, diabetes, those things kill way more people every year than the illicit drugs combined. If we're saying that it's okay to eat so many cheeseburgers that you give yourself heart disease and cost millions of dollars to the community and our insurance rates go up as a result of that, then why not these drugs that are less harmful than cheeseburgers, right? I'm a cheeseburger user. I will say it. I'm Sean. My name is Sean. I'm a cheeseburger user, you know, but no cop has ever kicked down my door because I ordered a cheeseburger. You know, one of the things you hear is like, well, people aren't robbing people for cheeseburgers, but I would pose that you make cheeseburgers illegal and see what kind of black market, what kind of cartels start around illegal black market cheeseburgers. The criminalization of drugs has created the crime behind drugs. All you have to do is look back to our own alcohol prohibition during the 20s and 30s to recognize that when you make something that people naturally want to do, either as a recreation or to ease pain or to soothe themselves, you make that illegal and you are going to create crime around access to that.
Yeah, I think the demonization of certain kinds of drug use affects how we judge people. But let's talk about the fact that if you look at people experiencing homelessness, there does seem to be a higher percentage of those people who experience some kind of substance use. Can we talk a little bit about why do we see a higher rate?
The significant growth of homeless numbers across the country, definitely in our large cities, are more likely or not a space where daily traumatic experience of being homeless will actually make people develop a different relationship with drug and alcohol as a method of what we call coping, because the barriers keep growing. The barriers to housing keep growing. The barriers of having to move your encampment, having to move your RV. I mean, all of the ways in which people, I always say, work 24/7 when they're unhoused, definitely has driven up the percentages that we see in terms of chaotic drug use.
Can I just say to that point too, Gabor Mate's quote about addiction is a response to pain, right? We need to stop asking why so much addiction and start asking why so much pain. I saw something on social media recently that said trauma is the gateway drug. And if you look at people experiencing homelessness, you're often looking at people who have pretty intensive trauma histories way before drug use began. And you take something like the ACE study, the Adverse Childhood Experience study, and the connection that trauma has to later disease, mental health issues, and substance use. There's been studies that measure the reduction of the volume of the hippocampus in people that have experienced trauma and how there is a direct correlation to drug use because these systems are dysregulated in the brain. That's one of the reasons why you would perhaps see an increase in a population that is a trauma population as opposed to people who have not had those stressors. But the other thing to remember is that these are people we're assessing. Everybody on the street gets assessed and asked this question. And then we take the data and we come up with these percentages. But people who live in homes don't get assessed. So we're guessing at what those numbers are. So I don't trust any of the numbers, to be honest. I don't think they point us in any helpful direction, really.
We judge terribly people living on the streets who use drugs to deal with trauma, pain, fear, staying awake, not getting assaulted, all of those things. all of us out there use some kind of drug. It could be caffeine. It could be that cheeseburger you talked about. It could be things that are harmful to us and could also be harmful to those around us, but we don't judge them, but we do judge people who use substances to deal with the pain. Laura, you had something you wanted to say.
Stigma kills. Stigma kills. Stigma gets in the way of people seeking very important services and treatment. I managed a program for 16 years. You know, we did overdose prevention. It was engagement, engaging our community to feel loved, that is non-stigmatizing. We call Hamrachan as love because what it is to also get to understand that sometimes the most violent systems are outside of the people. And therefore, we have to do an intentional destigmatizing work because our folks will not seek treatment if they are treated like subhumans. You cannot be referring to human beings as zombies and expect that they're going to respond and they're going to come to any place where they're seen as zombies. So I just want to say the very thing that we engage in, this judgmental approach, authoritarian approach, is the thing that will be the least workable, the least effective to actually get our folks to engage in services, let alone treatment.
You know, without harm reduction, we would never have arrived at housing first. I know that for a fact. Everything that we know that is considered a best practice that has to do with uplifting human beings, connecting them to community, to purpose, to meaning, to love in their lives, the things we all require to be okay and to heal, that's harm reduction. The recognition that yeah, we as human beings make decisions mostly based on trauma that have the potential to hurt us. But the real harm is coming from broken systems. We have unfair laws and marginalization and racism and all those things. The criminalization of drugs, for instance, causes way more death, separation of families and communities, way more destruction than the drugs themselves ever could.
And that leads me to the next question about what we're seeing right now in our communities and our government policies, where we are moving back to this idea of forced treatment. Would either one of you like to address this treatment model that we're seeing coming back and how effective is it?
Yeah, our treatment model sucks. Our abstinence-based models are terrible. They're full of negative language, stigmatizing people, shaming people. I lump in our mental health system as well. This is all about pathologizing people, right? It's about placing the blame on the individual, looking at what we consider an illness and not the wholeness of the person. We pathologize people, but we fail to look at the systems that are creating more harm than the drugs themselves ever could. The drug and alcohol treatment, in my opinion, is a system of harm. Our mental health system is a system of harm. I know that sounds a little bit crazy because these are both systems that are set up ostensibly to help people, but I think they perpetuate this shame and the stigma that Laura is describing. And I love that idea of harm reduction being defined as love. That's what this is all about. This is about unconditional positive regard. It's about uplifting the individual. It's about allowing people to make choices about what they choose to do with their bodies and not separating them from our community because of that. For over 100 years, we have had a campaign, an indoctrination around drug use and drug users, most of it based in racist practice, laws, and policy. And we have come as a community and a society to believe those things that we've been told. That has been all done to prop up a for-profit private prison system that requires bodies, most of them black and brown bodies, unfortunately, to make money off of. And that's why we don't engage in sane drug policy in this country, because there's too much money to be made in incarcerating people for nonviolent life choices or appetites. These are appetites. We all have them. Some of them are legal and some of them we've made illegal. Forced treatment doesn't work. We know that.
The opioid epidemic in particular has brought some real challenges to these programs because what it's called abstinence-based treatments actually are harmful to someone that is experiencing what is called opiate use disorder, which will necessitate, to make sure that people don't die, that there is an intervention that may support that person from transitioning from opiates to something like methadone or buprenorphine, other forms of opiate treatment that now are available, not accessible, and also not necessarily tailored or done in a way that really is outreaching to the people who need it. And then there is no evidence in the last 50 to 60 years of research that shows that mandatory treatment works. So politicians can talk about it. people can be like the way to not see people on the streets to say, let's lock them up. That hasn't worked. Not only the research doesn't show it works, it hasn't worked. It hasn't worked. Criminalization and mandatory treatment has not worked for the last 50 to 60 years. So it's almost like putting money where we don't need it.
Yeah. And it's not we're saying it's a free-for-all, do what you want, we love you, it's all great. That's not what we're saying. It's that we accept you as you are.
And we say, we meet you where you're at, but we're not going to leave you there. And in fact, syringe service programs, which are the most commonly called harm reduction programs, actually link people to more services than any other treatment program that I'm aware of. And that includes behavioral health or drug treatment programs or jail release. So we have 30 years of documentation about the ways in which harm reduction programs don't leave people there and link up with housing, with hepatitis and HIV testing and treatment, with substance use treatment, et cetera, et cetera. So actually, we have more documentation of the ways in which those programs help more people than many other programs that are out there.
And to me, if there's anything to remember this whole conversation, I love what you just said. We meet people where they're at, but we don't meet them there. And I think that is the essence of harm reduction. There was one thing that I did want to touch on, because there is this perception that for society's good, like people who are on drugs are violent, they're committing crimes, dangerous to our neighborhood. So that's why forced treatment or getting them off the street is good. Laura, can you talk a little bit about that perception? Is it true that people out there using drugs, they're violent criminals?
That's not my experience. And I work with people for a long time. The majority of people that I served that were people who were unhoused and people who may have had chaotic relations with drugs and alcohol were actually engaging in survival. So that's not my experience. But I want to say the same way we extrapolate all homeless people, and I hear the word homeless, I always say unhoused people are addicts. We also say all homeless people who are addicts are criminals. So I want to say that we extend those metaphors in a way that is irresponsible, that do not necessarily pertain to reality. In fact, our folks get targeted so much more than a lot of other violent criminals who are wealthy and will never get caught because they'll pay a good criminal defense attorney and get out.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an important point. Thank you. So this has been an amazing conversation. I appreciate all of the wisdom from both of you. Let me ask just a final, what would you like to leave our audience with today? Laura, let me start with you.
I think that hopefully this is a segment where we're calling the listeners for awareness. I think that actually if we stay away from the stereotypes, which are very human, but if you stay away from the stereotypes and you really go a deep dive on looking at what's real, what are facts, were not facts, when you start really challenging your own notion, it actually opens possibilities for other ways to see our community supporting and helping to go in the direction which we know not only we keep treating people as human beings, but also that there is actual pathways for support and pathways for people not to actually end up in the very situation they are right now. And I think that the strategies of criminalization, mandatory treatment, all the things that we know don't work, will actually get people to feel really frustrated when they see that they will not result in the results that kind human beings really expect of our communities.
Wonderful. Thank you. Sean, I'll throw it over to you. What would you like to leave our audience with today?
I would encourage people to research the history of drug control and prohibition and find out, like, why was it that these drugs, cocaine, opium, or heroin, marijuana, why were those drugs made illegal originally? And these other drugs that we also know are much more harmful, like alcohol and tobacco, remained legal. If you dive into that a little bit, what you're going to see is that the drugs we have demonized and that we're punishing and incarcerating people for are not any different than the ones that we have made legal. And so, yeah, I guess that's it. The normalizing of people who are in pain and using substances to soothe, but also the recognition that people use all sorts of substances for all sorts of reasons, some of them very good, some of them very creative. And they don't end up in problematic relationships with those drugs. And that's a lot of people we call drug users who don't have those kind of chaotic relationships with drugs.
Wonderful. Thank you. Well, again, the two of you have been amazing and a lot of food for thought today. It is not an easy topic, but I really encourage our listeners to read more and find out more about, as Sean said, the history around drug use, and also recognize that there is so much stigmatization out there that sometimes the truth gets lost in these myths and misperceptions, and who suffers from that are the very people we want to help. If you want to learn more or support our work at Union Station Homeless Services, you can log into our website at unionstationhs.org. Again, that's unionstationhs.org. Thank you for joining us and listening to this episode. I encourage you to subscribe and listen to all our episodes and help us change the narrative about homelessness in our neighborhoods. Together, we can be the solution we want to see in our communities. This podcast is produced by Brenda Lynch and Katie Cookerley-Dietrich,
edited by Matthew Patrick Davis,
production assistance and music by Colin Feldman. Special thanks to our Union Station Homeless Services Lived Expertise Advisory Panel, or LEAP, for their insights.